Oswald Penitentiary is open for business, and Studio Ghibli has a new Pretty Pretty Princess. This week on 30-2010.
30-2010, 30-2010, 3 decades, every show, sometimes us, the videos. 30-2010, 30-2010, the presses are awaiting if we're going to the 80s and the 90s and 2000s. From 30-2010.
Oh boy, everybody. Welcome to another fun-filled episode of 30-2010, your weekly look back 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and 10 years ago into the past. This week is July 7th through the 13th. Hi, I'm one of your hosts, Chris Antista.
I'm Dave Booger Rudden.
I'm Henry Adebisi Gilbert.
Damn!
I'm Diana Goodman, and I'm okay to go!
Well, this is a very exciting week.
Okay to go.
We have some, like, genuine... Both types of classic movies.
Mm.
Ones you can't recommend, probably won't be able to recommend, and ones that win Oscars in this episode. A little better TV, and who knows, maybe some fun games. Stay tuned, because we're going to open a window into 30, 20, and 10 years ago into the past.
Ahoy, ahoy, everybody. This is Bob Mackey.
Chris Antista.
Henry Gilbert.
And when you're done listening to this, we'd like you to check out Talking Simpsons. It's our chronological exploration of The Simpsons only on the Leisure Time Podcast Network.
Where we occasionally talk sports.
Daryl.
When we throw people under the bus, name names like the insidious
Mr. Black.
And we're the one podcast that will never sell out to foreign interests.
Ooh, the Germans are mad at me. I'm so scared. Ooh, the Germans.
For all this and more, listen to Talking Simpsons every Wednesday at TalkingSimpsons.com or wherever you find your podcasts.
This being 1987, July 7th through the 13th, Oliver North begins Iran-Contra testimony. I'd like to say it on the record that this is a great game. I didn't know it was Iranian.
I don't recall. I don't recall.
Oh, man. This is the headliner. I mean, we've had Iran-Contra. Like, we haven't really covered it because we were coming up to this. It was the headline moment. Mm-hmm. You know, this stuff goes back about a year when the Iran-Contra started to break. The whole, like, wait, did we give guns to Iran in exchange for hostages and then take that money and funnel it to the Contras? Both of those things are illegal, and what? Who knew what? And whose idea was it? And did the president know? And what are we doing?
Not illegal if the president does it.
So yeah, as the Iran-Contra thing would prove, it apparently isn't illegal if the president does it.
Yeah, so, I mean, the headliner, the guy behind really everything was pointing to was Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North. Mm-hmm. Who was on, I think, the National Security Council.
Mm-hmm.
He had directed his secretary, Fawn Hall, to shred tons of stuff. They had a shredding party. It was sort of, it's one of those things where it's like, your political beliefs affect how you saw this go down. A lot of people mm-hmm. saw this guy as, here's a patriot standing up for what is right.
Did what he had to do.
He did what he had to do, and it's important. And other people being like, this is some fucking bullshit. We're breaking laws left and right because we feel like it?
It's a gross ethical violation, and we can't walk ourselves back from this.
Yeah.
How do we fix it?
And, if it hadn't been a Republican-majority Congress, I feel impeachment would have happened over
I'm not really sure.
Do you think the North thing was enough plausible deniability and just put it on North?
I think there were enough guys in between North and Reagan that, I don't know, it was one of those things where, I mean, even Reagan did say, like, I didn't know, but maybe I should have known. So I think that helped protect him.
How can the president
him.
Not know? I mean,
it wasn't on a one-page memo with bullet points. Well, I'm doing impressions of other presidents to make fun of the current one. doesn't count as being political.
It did expose how far gone his mind was at that point. Reagan's was.
Oh, that's right, where he allegedly had Alzheimer's while in office.
In retrospect, we start to wonder what was going on.
But don't think about that.
This dominated TV, though.
It did.
This was because it's the summer and TV shuts down. Yeah. So there's just live hearings on all channels. This is all anyone gives a crap about.
I wouldn't have known about it. It also dominated at least one cover of Mad Magazine, therefore bringing it into my world.
Yeah. So it does get kind of complicated, and I tried to do some research, and I got into it, but we're trying to keep shows a little bit shorter now. So I hate to recommend another podcast, but Whistle Stop, with the host of Face the Nation, did a whole episode just on the North testimony
and
the background.
I'm very unclear on the whole situation.
And it's a really, really good episode. So Whistle Stop Podcast.
All right.
And that Mad Magazine article, Iran-Contra.
Oliver Schmendrick North. That's there's no good way to segue into the movies, but there are a lot of them, including some
there's
I've never heard of.
A lot we have to talk about.
It's officially summer movie season in 1987. But from July 7th to the 13th, Made to Order with Ali Sheedy.
Ooh, this sounds bad.
It's you'll never guess how Made is spelled, but it looks like that might be what Ali Sheedy does for a living.
Ali Sheedy can still open a movie. She's a cute young lady.
Yeah. And as a maid. Hamana.
Funny, we've all seen it and heard of it then.
Yeah, the idea, it's like a reverse Cinderella. She's a rich, spoiled bitch, and then I think her dad wishes she never existed, and then she ends up as a maid.
I sent you to be his butler.
Just about, yeah. Then she like learns stuff and absolutely critically pale.
Falls in love with someone on the other side of the tracks. Beautiful. I've never heard of this. O.C. and Stiggs, a Robert Altman road comedy based on a National Lampoon. It was shelved for 4 years.
I'm sort of fascinated by this because you don't usually think Robert Altman in big comedy.
Yeah.
Like, he's got a lot of funny stuff in his movies. MASH,
Brewster McCloud. Jesus
but
Christ.
You don't think wacky road sex romp, but that's apparently what this was. And they obviously fought with the studios, and there were script problems, and it was shelved for, like 4 years.
Wow.
And then just
never
dripped
heard of this.
Out, made no money, nobody likes it. Even Robert Altman said, like, I fucked up.
Wow. Jesus, so many movies. The Squeeze with Michael Keaton, which I get to showcase every year in my famous article, semi-famous article, 11 innocuous movie posters ruined by 9/11. And this gets to be the figurehead of it because it's Michael Keaton being squeezed between the Twin Towers as they're cracking.
Yes. It's quite an image. But all it was meant to represent was a guy struggling in New York City. That's all it was meant.
Michael Keaton strikes me as one of the nicest people with so many weird regrets that aren't really his fault.
Nah.
Everything with Batman. Mm. Anyway, Whitewater Summer with Kevin Bacon, the prequel to The River Wild, I'm going to guess. But I want to get into the big stuff here because I cannot...
There's too many goddamn
movies. I cannot believe these all... But these all were released on... These are some of my favorite movies of all time.
Wow. Yeah.
All three of them, but wildly different. First of all, we have Revenge of the Nerds 2.
Nerds in Paradise.
Which, come on, this was our gateway into the Revenge of the Nerds universe. And when you find out to the first ones... Mostly a rape fantasy.
This is more fun.
I watch them in the proper order because my brother taped both off of HBO during a free weekend, which was during Christmas. Because I remember interstitials between the movies was Ogre opening Christmas presents. It's the weirdest thing, one of those things where it was like I would pay dozens of dollars to see this online somewhere, but I don't think it exists.
So,
but
happy holidays. I guess they realized after the first one, which was a raunchy sex comedy, that more kids liked it than they thought.
Which
Police Academy syndrome, as it was.
I think they did want to make a Police Academy movie and ended up having young nerds imprint themselves on some of these characters.
We did an episode a while ago on Laser Time about movies that got downgraded.
Evolution of the Nerd, it's called.
Well, that, but also we had an episode where movies that went from R to PG or something. I think we talked about this. We might have missed
this
it.
This film,
it was one of the first I saw. I got to see it because my dad had watched Revenge of the Nerds 2 with me. Of course you can rent that. I didn't know all this nudity and sex was in the first one.
Well, and this film franchise is also about identity politics, except the identity is being a nerd. And the nerds are refused a hotel room because the rich, the jocks got it.
The hotel oral sex, I believe.
Yes.
And then they're going to shut it down. They're going to make it so you have to be physically fit as well to be part of the fraternity and not just hit your... Scholastic things. It was called Proposition 15, and so then the nerds fight it the only way they know how to with a rap at a special concert.
People in the place. Here's a story about some guys that are bound for glory. I'll get right down to the nitty gritty. The triple L queen is gonna rock this thing. I'm the L A M, the A and the R, the man on the mic that they call Lamar. And there's a couple of things that I'd like to say about Prop 15. It's not okay. Now I'm no jock, no football hero, but that don't mean I'm an absolute zero.
Holy shit, that's wonderful.
Oh my God.
But such a sequel thing.
What they're wearing.
The first one, they did a way better dance song at the end.
I just, when Henry brought up identity politics, it is bizarre what a smaller world we live in because it was the Asian fixated on Elvis, the gay black guy, the gross farter, the smart nerd, the catatonic Spectrum fella, all grouped under just nerd. That's just all you were. You were either an incast or an outcast. Mm-hmm. And at the time, that's just so strange. Every one of those people would have a hyper specific Facebook group and newsletter at this point.
And technically, Anthony Edwards is in it.
Oh, there he is.
I think his performance is contractually like the most contractually obligated thing I've ever seen. He's in there for 2 minutes at the beginning, saying, "Sir, I broke my leg and can't go on the trip with you guys." And then is out. Oh, he shows up in a flashback sequence at the end, but that's it.
Because I love schlock, I really did love this series, and they made Fox, when it launched as a network, didn't have much to go on, but made two straight-to-TV movies and publicized them pretty huge. And I those, for some reason, were airing on the El Rey Network recently, and I watched them.
Oh. I mean, the main nerd and Booger are easy to get back. They did not become movie stars.
Robert Carradine has become the default host of Revenge of the Nerds. There's had a reality show for a while. Him and Booger.
That one. But the first movie, I think, is better in almost every single regard, except for the villain. Like, Ted McGinley, he's good, but in this one, they got Bradley Whitford.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
And his speech at the end is amazing. Yeah. What are you going to do, Skolnick? You going to get your friends? These pencil neck geeks.
And then Ogre has a face turn. Ogre's Tom Hitch can finally love Ogre. Yeah. And I remember the end of the movie where he drinks the punch and joins the LLL, and he becomes an officially a nerd. Yeah. It was beautiful.
It is, but that's not even the most exciting movie for me to talk about. I've revisited this and can confirm a genuine classic.
It was a newsflash I picked up yesterday about a dog. In an amazing show of loyalty and courage, a terrier named Grover traveled hundreds of miles to be reunited with his owner. The poor little critter was accidentally left behind on a fishing trip 3 weeks ago and had to find his way across rugged mountain peaks and scorching deserts in order to get home. Little Grover turned out to be one spunky pup.
If a dog can do it, we can do it!
Yay! The Brave Little Toaster!
It's Toy Story!
Essentially, Toy Story.
Yeah. It's Toy Story.
It's wonderful to think about it that way, and I've always wanted to dig more into the history of The Brave Little Toaster, a movie that I guess came out in 1987. I don't think any of us saw it then.
No.
I think we saw it on a VHS released much later.
Or on Disney Channel.
Making it look like a Disney property, but this being a movie that was brought to Disney consistently, and they consistently said no. They were working with Disney. It's John Lasseter. It's Pixar working, trying to get a movie off the ground. The writer is Joe Raft, the guy who wrote Toy Story and up until
all
his death,
the
all the Pixar movies.
Yes,
has a lot of Pixar credibility. Pixar people in the credits, but Disney did not want to make it, and they had to start a bunch of ex-Disney people had to start another studio, Hyperion Studio, and Disney eventually acquired it. Made it into a straight-to-video trilogy. But I know I was introduced to it on a white Disney clamshell that made it look like Pinocchio or Peter Pan. It was not. It was something they didn't seem to have a lot of faith in until they saw it with a third of the budget Disney had originally offered it. And it's really good.
It is really good. It is a dark-ass movie. I was rewatching so many scenes. I was like, oh, man, this
is
harsh.
In hindsight, very Pixar.
Very Pixar.
Very
Pixar.
Pixar
goes... Pixar was known for going all the places like, well, Disney wouldn't be this hard on children. Not so in Brave Little Toaster. Like, there's the last song in the movie is cars singing about their impending death. And like, I used to have this awesome life as a car. Now I'm dead. And then they are crushed, often off screen, but you know they are dead.
Yeah.
And they're singing, worthless.
Yes.
Like, that's harsh,
man. It's not unlike Toy Story. Obviously, it's a bunch of sentient appliances around the house, including Phil Hartman turning into a rad Jack Nicholson performance as the air conditioner, who dies visibly of a heart attack on screen. This movie, it's dark, but it's very, in hindsight, it's very Pixar. John Lasseter had wanted it to be the first CG movie. They could not get the budget to do that.
No way.
And this is how it turned out. And I think it's unforgettable. It's gorgeous. Just Brave Little Toaster deserves its nostalgia.
So yeah, it's a bunch of appliances that were loved by this little kid, which is where this kid cared so much about his appliances. But they've been abandoned by moving, and so they're going across the country to be found by them. And it's also too, I forgot, the Brave Little Toaster saves the boy from death by jumping into the gears of a machine and being mangled to death.
Yeah. It's really
but
strange.
Gets, yeah. But gets rebuilt. They don't linger on it for too long because I think even then they're like, this is too much for children. We are caught. We're going to destroy lives.
Maybe it was like the mandate. Like, yeah, Disney doesn't want to make it. We're going to make this the most not Disney movie of all time. Because even the little electric blanket is a kid character. And like, it's heartbreaking to look at the world through his eyes. Yeah. He's constantly kicked
it's
in the
this
dick.
Bad, huh? Yeah. And at the and it's filled of Second City people too, because they John Lovitz and Hartman among them, because they've John Raft was from Second City in the Groundlings, and I remember hearing on some Mr. Show commentary that also alums Bob Odenkirk and Jill Talley are saying, like, you believe that guy's got a fucking Oscar now? That guy we used to do stuff with in the 80s. Like, that's how crazy it is. So, yeah, that was Brave Little Toaster gave me nightmares as a kid, but I did love it.
And we got to get to our next movie because it might be the one most of the people listening remember, or at least the most people have seen.
Mm-hmm. Where in hell are you from anyway, Private? Sir, Texas, sir! Holy dog shit, Texas, only steers and queers come from Texas, Private Cowboy. And you don't much look like a steer to me, so that kind of narrows it down. Do you suck dicks?
Sir, no, sir!
Are you a Peter Pepper?
Sir, no, sir!
I'll bet you're the kind of guy that would fuck a person in the ass and not even have the goddamn common courtesy to give him a reach around. I'll be watching you.
I love it.
This is... oh, my God.
Full metal jacket.
Yeah, my dad loved this movie, which meant it was one of the more racy things I was allowed to watch. Mm. And as a result, everything Sergeant Hartman, played by Arlie Ermey, I'm kind of shocked he's still alive.
Yep. Hey, it's that clean living in the Marines, man. Yeah. Take care of himself.
Everything he said became a catchphrase, and it made half of the movie a lot less interesting.
Really two different movies. I've seen the first half of this movie like dozens of times, and the second half probably like two or three times.
I encourage you to watch the second half again. It's really good.
Mm-hmm. It's just so dark, and it's like the first half is also very dark, but it's just... just such different.
This is also the sad time when Stanley Kubrick could make one film a decade, it was just like that. It was either hard for him to get funding, or when he would get funding, then it would take him a long time to film it, and then he'd film it, and he's like, "Well, I got to edit this for 8 years." But this was his Vietnam film. He had been wanting to make a Napoleon film, just couldn't get it going. So then he's going to make his Vietnam film, and he wants the Marine training to be the Marine training. Mm-hmm. And so he fucking gets Arlie Ermey hires a Marine,
an actual
drill sergeant to do his shit on film. It's like, how much of this was written for him, and how much was him, like, obviously knowing Stanley Kubrick, it was all meticulously written for him to do. But
did he not have like a lot of roles before this?
No. I think he was hired as the consultant, and there was an actor hired to play the part, and they just didn't like the actor compared to him. Mm-hmm. So they just brought him in. And I guess, some of the things he's saying, he's just ad-libbing.
Yeah, are things he would scream at actual enlisted
because
men.
Because the job of a drill sergeant is to destroy you and then build you back up. And the first 6 minutes, like, we could have just played the entire first 6 minutes of it.
It's so embarrassing.
Of him yelling at everybody.
I love this movie so much. Loved it as a kid. Loved rediscovering it in my 20s. And it was playing on HBO... during a sexual encounter with a girl, and I couldn't stop mouthing the lines of Arlie Ermey into her ear.
Were you telling her, this is my rifle, this is my gun, this is for fighting, this is for fun?
You could suck a golf ball through a garden hose.
Soldier boy.
I was downtown, so I deserve some.
I'm going to beat you with soap wrapped in a sock.
And it's too bad for Matthew Modine, who is the lead of this film, that he is overshadowed by two incredible performances.
For
half of the movie. And then the second half...
Adam Baldwin, Jane Cobb, overshadowing Miss Animal Mother.
But in the first half, too, it is Vincent D'Onofrio's film. He is Private Pyle, the soft boy who is letting down everybody else because you were hungry. And he's Private Pyle... He is a fuck up, and that he's eventually like, I've been punishing you too much. Mm-hmm. I'm going to punish everybody else, so they will beat the shit out of you
so
for me.
It just breaks him.
That he sees
Private Pyle out of his bunk. Why aren't you disarming him?
Yes, and then he even gets the tagline. He gets to say Full Metal Jacket. And Vincent D'Onofrio forever defines portraying a crazy person on film in the part of Private
A person
Pyle.
Driven to madness. Yeah. I thought that was the important lesson.
That's the lesson that you get out of the first half. It's not just we got to break them down individually and build them up, but we need to break them down and build them into a unit. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways you can do that is give them an enemy. Mm. And we're going to torture the weak guy.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's so strange, though, that it's like, the second half I can see as being the thing that Kubrick would want to do. Mm-hmm. It's just, I don't know.
It feels like a real war movie.
Yeah, it's so weird to think of, like, that this part, the basic training part, just seems not as Kubricky, and then you kind of watch it thinking it's not as meticulously framed.
I mean,
as, you know, the framing isn't the thing that you're noticing, and you realize, oh, it's a psychological thing.
What other
him.
Kubrick movie is famous for long streaks of dialogue?
And that much dialogue, it
doesn't
strange
exist.
Strange Love, maybe.
Strange Love is a good one.
Strange Love is very dialogue heavy. Definitely, there are some monologues by Jack in The Shining, but like Arlie Ermey just controls every second he's on screen, and it's amazing. And he would be typecast forever to be this guy who is him.
Who is him? But he's not an actor. He has a fucking talking doll.
Yeah.
Because of this, how the iconic nature of this role is Sergeant Hartman.
And he would basically be hired in every movie for 20 years to be this guy again. Yeah. And I loved him the most in It was the Steve Zahn Jack Black movie.
Oh, Saving Silverman.
Saving Silverman.
It came up again. Yes.
He helps kidnap, they help him kidnap that girl. And then at the end, he admits he's like, well, I'm gay. And then he marries Jack Black at the end of the movie.
I thought you were going to say Colonel Happablap.
Yeah. He is also Colonel Happablap.
Colonel Happablap. Yeah. And also, I didn't even remember it. We were watching, Talking Simpsons. We're going over Sweet Seymour Skinner's Badass Song, the show's 100th episode. A big deal and a very good episode. But like the Drill Sergeant sequence is a direct reference to Full Metal Jacket.
Yes.
And you wouldn't know that if not for the absolute deliberate framing of that shot, which looks really hard, so Simpsons can get
a couple
March jokes in.
I mean, it has incredible cinematography by Stanley Kubrick, and you also, knowing how many takes you've heard Stanley Kubrick does for every movie, I haven't read about it in this that they did the same in this movie, but you have to assume Arlie Ermey has that much energy for, like, what? If he's told to do a dozen takes, he still has that same energy? Cool. Like, it's incredible.
Yeah. And I have to say, I really do like the second half of this movie.
Me too.
It does feel really different. It still blows my mind that it's filmed in England.
Yeah.
They're filming at Battersea Station, you know, from the Pink Floyd cover.
And
you can't tell. It looks like it's really hot there. It's probably like, it's probably just raining and 50 degrees.
Obey my word like the wood of God.
And I do love at the end of the movie, too.
No,
they're
boom
all
boom for Soul Brother. Alabama Black Snake. That all comes in the second half.
And they end the film with them singing Mickey Mouse because they just show, like, these are children. Like, these are children you made killers.
And then ends with Paint It Black. Introduces me to the song Paint It Black.
Yeah, which would become a cliche after this movie to use another movie.
Yeah, to end that in your film with Paint It Black, but it happened here first.
Hey, I liked it in Devil's Advocate.
All right, so moving to TV of 1987. We are in the date range of July 7th through the 13th. What's this?
Very weird week. Sweet Surrender, an NBC sitcom starring Dana Delaney.
Who the fuck is Dana Delaney?
I only know her from the Animaniacs opening.
She was the star of China Beach.
But yeah, here's this instrumental theme playing in the background. I actually have no idea what it is, but I love the theme.
Yeah, are you sure this is from 1987?
Yes.
Sounds like a snow cone man is pulling up.
But there's some other noteworthy stuff to talk about this week.
We also have what?
So on July 11th, NBC airs the pilot for Good Morning, Miss Bliss, which is not Saved by the Bell at all.
So in case
you don't know, Good Morning, Miss Bliss was a Haley Mills vehicle that would have, I believe, Screech and Zach.
And Lisa.
And
Mr. Belding.
And Mr. Belding.
And they all live in Iowa or something.
And
it's
so
weird.
Then when Haley Mills, the show would get canceled, and Haley Mills wouldn't want to do a new version of it. Mm-hmm. They then just made it Saved by the Bell and starred Zach.
Yeah.
And then when they repackaged it for syndication,
they made the
Good Morning, Miss Bliss episodes be part of it. And then current day Zach would do an intro of, like, I remember when Mrs. Bliss was our teacher.
Yeah.
And
just forget the fact that we're halfway across the country altogether.
Yeah. So a year before that, they did the pilot for it, which they aired one time on NBC.
Okay.
And it would star Brian Austin Green in the lead kid role and a young African-American actor who I wonder if our listeners can recognize his voice.
The topic will be the most important person in my life. Does it have to be a real person, or can it be one of the kids on the Cosby Show?
I prefer someone real.
Is Vanna White real? Close enough.
I wouldn't have got the young non-nerd Stefan Urkel.
Yes.
Really young.
That he was, that he actually, it makes you realize how old he was when he was playing Urkel, that you see him as like a for real looking 10-year-old in a movie.
These kids are like actual kids. This isn't high school.
Well, yeah, but that the girl that was talking before, Jaleel White, I'm pretty sure she was a regular in Funky Brewster.
Yes,
she looks familiar to me.
I think so. But
this blew my mind.
Yeah,
like,
I've never heard of this until now either.
I have seen every Saved by the Bell episode way too many times because it was on every day at 4 and 5 o'clock on TBS and our local channel, Channel 11. And yeah, they would repackage those old episodes, and then they had the college years. I didn't know that they had a pilot that didn't include anybody. Like, no, actually nobody at all, like Miss Bliss, so but that's it.
It would be another year before, like...
It would be a year before they produced it as a regular show. There's actually a better... Like, that also tells you how lost this is. This was a clip that is straight off of somebody's VHS they taped that time, and there was a better Jaleel White line right after that, but in the middle, there's just a tracking problem in his line. So I was like, well, I guess can't use that clip, but yes.
It's very... Like, this is very weird. It seems like NBC strategy, where it's like, all right, we gave you a pilot, we'll wait a year, do the show, wait another 2 years, we'll do the real show. Like, just like Seinfeld, where it's like, this is a really slow burn to actually give the show the green light.
And when you're waiting with child actors, a whole year makes a big difference.
Oh, yeah. Puberty can strike at any moment, but on July 11th, 1987...
Well, puberty allegory.
Why did I never hear about this?
I don't know either, but yeah, Werewolf debuts on Fox, a single season, 28-episode horror series about a wolfman who, the basic like thrust of the series is that he's searching for the originator of the bloodline to kill him.
The head vampire.
And remove the werewolf curse.
Holy shit. Yeah. I never heard of this show either.
I mean, it's 1987 Fox, so it's like you're either a classic show like Tracy Ullman or Married with Children or 21 Jump Street, or you're the stuff that lasted 1 year.
I bet its budget was disgusting.
Probably.
Yes. No, the effects awful. But 1987 music, you'll never guess. I Want to Dance with Somebody is still numero uno on the charts. But we have new albums from Introducing the Hardline, according to Terrence Trent D'Arby. His debut, including Sign Your Name, Faster Pussycat, and a self-titled Buster Poindexter album.
Yeah.
No, hot.
Sign Your Name and Wishing Well were huge. And then Terrence Trent D'Arby went insane. So it's pretty funny.
Yes. But the Hot, where Buster Poindexter was the transformation of a punk icon into a pop one-hit wonder.
A very bizarre David Bowie turn from someone who doesn't deserve one. But no offense
to
Buster Poindexter.
I'm refusing to play that because, look, I don't know shit about rap, but I know Eric B. and Rakim are important. So it turns out, oh, shit, their big debut came out 30 years ago this week. And I Know You Got Soul is a really cool song. It's one of those, like, do I know that? And I listen to it, I'm like, yeah, I know that. Oh, I certainly know that sample. Mm. And that was sampled for something else. So it's in the middle of a sample sandwich. Eric B. and Rakim, I mean, they were big. I think as...
They are big parts of the bedrock of the hip-hop.
Yeah, as rap becomes hip-hop, I think they're a big turning point. So
well, let's enjoy some of that as we go out of 1987, but we will be back in just a moment with July 7th to the 13th in 1997. Please enjoy I Know You Got Sold.
You got it! You got it!
You like Laser Time shows? Then you might like Bonus Time, Laser Time's weekly bonus show exclusively on patreon.com/lasertime. Here's a taste of what you've been missing.
Yeah, I showed up there with like 40 minutes before my flight, just like 8 steps, I'm through security. It was so easy, though. This was the first time it's ever happened to me. I bought a Swiss Army knife. I was just feeling like it.
Amazon Gold Box. Okay. I'm calling it right now.
If you want to hear the actual reason, it was because it was on sale. And
so
it was,
what?
And it was right after... It was right after the election. I was thinking, like, I need a knife in case the world's over, which is stupid thinking.
A tiny knife.
The NRA has plans. You can see the Facebook video right now.
No, it's not a knife.
Stab you with my wine bottle
opener. It's not a knife to stab people. It's a tool. It's a tool.
It's a survival tool. You can open wine with it.
It's the worst version of all those tools.
I wasted money. It's true. But thank you. That's not our Henry. But I put it in my backpack and hadn't flown since I got it in November. And so I actually made it... I didn't know why. I forgot I had it. I made it to Long Beach with it in there, and nobody caught it in our wonderful TSA. When I flew back, that is when they caught it, and they're just like, you can put this in your car if you want. I was like, just throw it away. Goodbye, $20.
Get bonus time, Laser Time's weekly, full-length, uncensored, and ad-free Patreon-exclusive podcast, as well as full-length movie commentaries, wrestling and cartoon video commentaries, the first season of Talking Simpson, and more at patreon.com/lasertime, starting at just $5. You'll help us live, and we'll do our best to help you never be bored again. Have to tell you savvy internet people who that was. It's just bizarre to think of a world before walking on the All-Star.
All-Star is their big one.
This is Walking on the Sun. Yeah.
There was a brief time where that was their most famous song.
What a holy shit. Their debut album, Fushu Mang. Jesus Christ.
I actually own this album. I think I got my first CDs at like the end of 1997. This and we'll be talking about it in a couple months. Hang Ups from Goldfinger.
Yeah.
But yeah, this was pre All Star, so I wasn't like, you know,
I was in their cool days.
Yeah, their indie days. But they also had a cover that I actually like. Why Can't We Be Friends by Smash Mouth.
We did a show about bad cover songs, but I'll never forgive them for trying to cover Under Pressure.
Yeah.
You have one singer and he's
I'm a believer.
Doesn't count
of them. Yeah.
This is not singing.
Yeah.
It's just not.
I have a guilty pleasure on this album.
What?
Padrino is a really dumb song, but it's a lot of fun.
That deep with Smash Mouth.
I don't know where I heard it. I don't know why, but I somehow have the MP3. I don't know when that happened.
Changes my perception.
But it's like, it's got a fast ska beat, and it's just, it's really stupid, but it's really fun.
And they were super ska inspired, too. Yeah. They kind of like went away from that as they move forward past this album. But also new albums. By Primus, the Brown album, I believe. Vanishing Point by Primal Scream. Boys on the Docks, the first EP by the Dropkick Murphys.
Yeah.
And I'll Be Missing You by P. Diddle and Faith Evans. Still number one on the billboards. Man, we just talked about smoking last week. 1997 news, July 7th through the 13th. Joe Camel is retired after 9 years.
I did not realize it was only 9 years.
It was just during my most formative years.
Yeah, it seems like he's still around in some sort, but no.
They don't make fun of Joe Camel. But
that's why we did a Laser Time episode. You know, it's like this show, but topic based about dead media formats. And like just that week, right before we recorded, someone found some sample VHS from like a high def 1080p 60 frame a second, a very prototype material, and it's amazing to see New York in 1991, 1992
in
full
HD.
And part of that is because the enormous nature of Joe Camel. You have never seen him with that kind of clarity outside of a magazine scan. But a giant Joe Camel, dick and ball nose, cigarette hawking spokesman.
He looks like a giant penis.
Uncircumcised penis.
Yeah. And what's weird though is if you see there's like different Joe Camel slightly, like if you go into a black neighborhood, Joe Camel's nose is slightly different. They're trying to make him look black to appeal to people.
It's
interesting.
It's fucking weird.
I would run away occasionally, and next to Toys R Us was this old black nightclub called Fahrenheit, and there was still some liquor in there, but a lot of promotional material. It felt like wandering into an alternate universe where like everything here is black.
Advertised to a black audience as opposed to
here's that famous Budweiser poster, but with completely different people. It was insane. I collected a lot of it for a little while.
So they finally ended off Joe Camel just because people have been complaining for too long of like, this advertised it to children. Cartoon characters don't sell cigarettes to adults.
In hindsight, if you can ask a six-year-old, can you name one cigarette spokesman? And if he can say yes, somebody's doing something illegal.
Get rid of him. He did look like a penis.
And I still miss him though. I do.
You were a Camel smoker.
I was. Camel lights for life. Which they had to, even that's changed. They couldn't call them lights because it implies that it's less harmful for you than regular Camels, and they are not. They're Camel Blues now. That was something I never got used to saying before I quit and moved on to vape. I don't want to talk anymore about me because I'm pathetic. We'll move into movies of 1997, starting on let's call it July 7th. Mm-hmm. A Simple Wish. Martin Short. Coming in two episodes in a row.
Mara Wilson, well, that's the little girl, right?
Or, little girl Matilda. From Matilda. Mrs. Doubtfire. Yeah.
She's funny on Twitter. Mm-hmm. I don't know this movie, though, at all.
He was a magical creature
with great wishes.
Probably the perfect Martin Short vehicle, but probably not very good either.
Yeah, that's the word.
Four Little Girls. I've never heard of this.
Oh, what a fun movie. Spike Lee is really underrated as a documentarian. I actually
When the Levee Breaks is really good.
Oh, my God.
It's one of the greatest things ever.
I mean, it's awful to watch, but it's great.
Painful to watch, but that's how well he did it.
And this is the same. This is painful to watch.
If you've ever heard of the Birmingham bombings of 1963, which is a horrible, horrible thing, this is Spike Lee telling the story of it, which is a black church in Birmingham, Alabama, was bombed by terrorists, as in white nationalist people, who killed all these children. And it is a horror film that it wasn't a big extreme of violence back then in the civil rights era, but hardly isolated incident then. But it was just such an extreme that people remember it so hard back then, you know?
Yeah, just the idea. I mean, previously, an activist gets killed or this guy gets killed. There's a lynching. Obviously, those are really fucking horrible. But the idea of let's attack a community center and try to kill as many people as we can because we're racist. Mm-hmm. Let's try to kill everyone. And who do you end up killing? You kill four little girls in a bathroom.
Oh, God.
We're just like washing their hands and fixing their hair. And it's terrible.
Okay, I do remember hearing about this now.
You can learn all about it in the Four Little Girls documentary.
Yeah,
that Spike Lee did.
Really good.
In even worse news, Jodie Foster in Contact.
Jodie Foster, it was... No, it was that movie last year.
No?
It was
what?
I'm trying to make a joke.
Sounds
like
at
it.
It's going to be funny.
the Amy Adams movie from last year.
Arrival.
It was Arrival 20 years early, but Contact and Arrival have a lot in common, man.
Shitty twist.
There was no alien they could show you in Contact that would be
the novel by Carl Sagan.
That it was supposed to feel like. What it tells the story of, like, what really for real would happen if aliens contacted us right now. And it was a very in America, it was a lot about bureaucracy, it was a lot about how the media would play it, it was about earning your right to do it through the
religion,
too.
Belief. Like, what does this say about God? I mean, do they have a Bible? Is it the same God?
And
can we explain our God to them?
And Jodie Foster plays the person who's going to go into outer space. So when they trick you into thinking she won't, it's an even better trick in the movie. But that she is a girl who grew up wanting to speak to aliens all the time because she lost her father. Let's hear her explain why.
You're right. It's crazy. In fact, it's even worse than that. Nuts. Want to hear something really nutty? I heard of a couple guys that want to build something called an airplane. You know, you get people to go in it and they fly around like birds. It's ridiculous, right? Or what about breaking the sound barrier? Or rockets to the moon? Or atomic energy? Or a mission to Mars? Science fiction, right? Look, all I'm asking is for you to just have the tiniest bit of vision. You know, to step back for 1 minute and look at the big picture. To take a chance on something that just might end up being the most profoundly impactful moment for humanity, for the history of history.
She does a lot of great monologues like that in the movie, and that she is also like a hardcore atheist, but then has romantic entanglement with Matthew McConaughey.
Oddly miscast Matthew McConaughey.
Yes, who is a very religious man. Which
all
is
Christ,
like,
all Christ, all Christ.
And I remember this was the first time I ever complained about a trailer. It was an important time for me as a complainer. But that I see the movie, then the week after the movie comes out, you can tell that the motion picture company is just like, nobody's watching this. So they make a new trailer that reveals the ending that she goes into space. Like, you're supposed to wonder if she's going to go into space all the time. And they're like, No, let's show her travel to space in the newest commercial. Like, this ruins the fucking movie if you know she goes into space.
That's, yeah. That reveal is also why you can now understand it's the perfect Robert Zemeckis movie.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I want to make a movie based on something popular, but it needs a reason for me to pioneer some kind of technology.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and so when she meets her dad...
Finish talking about meeting your dad, because I want to talk about some of the incredible effects work in this movie.
Well, when she meets her dad, that is kind of... I rewatched the series, so like... This is the stuff you used in Beowulf and Christmas Carol. This is you testing out this test.
Yep.
It is a Zemeckis film, in case you didn't know that.
I think I love that man. He made my favorite movie ever, Who Framed Roger Rabbit. A very tough movie to make.
One that there were definitely people then who hated the twist of like, I paid to see an alien and show me your dad. It was a joke on South Park about how pissed off they were.
Mr. Garrison threw up over him.
Mr. Garrison is hearing all these disgusting things and it's not making him throw up. And then the doctor says like, oh, I also saw that new movie, Contact. I waited 2 fucking hours and saw her dad.
So the stupid thing I remember about it, this is Robert Zemeckis coming off the mega success of Forrest Gump.
Yes.
I don't think he ever achieved those heights again. You forget that guy also made Back to the Future.
Yes.
Can you believe it? Same dude. Mm-hmm. 10 years apart. But he made Contact, and in that movie he had given voice to former presidents.
Oh,
I believe he said he had
yes.
to go pee. So in this movie, he opted to have a CG mouth over Bill Clinton and give him
over
lines.
Real footage of him.
Over real footage of Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton had a big fucking problem with this. Yeah. Like, hey, maybe don't portray me in a movie telling people to prepare for aliens.
Only Conan O'Brien may do that.
I think it showed him, it was a wake-up call for politicians of like, wait, computers have gotten so good that you can make me say things?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, this is bad.
I'm sure it was some CG panic there, but it also, like, maybe we shouldn't do that. It didn't really ever happen again. And I think CNN also said, after this, our actual newscasters cannot appear in fictional films. Having just watched the season of House of Cards, I'm guessing that rule is out the fucking window.
That rule's way gone now.
But for a long time it was. You could license the CNN logo, but you had to hire an actor to play a fake news anchor.
Well, on Arrival also just has footage of Obama in it.
You can just use
Obama
footage. Just repurpose footage with the idea of like making him say something. Like, I can't wait to send Jodie Foster to the Mars. Yeah. Whatever.
If you watch Forrest Gump now, the worst thing in those films is the president's mouth.
Yeah.
It looks terrible.
Well, and then James Woods he's the government official heading it all up, and you get some great scenes of James Woods and Jodie Foster yelling at each other, and it's so great.
So let me talk about the effects. There is an effects shot in this movie that is so fucking good, and it is so subtle. I love when Zemeckis messes with effects and does subtlety. Her dad has a heart problem. They're downstairs. He collapses, and there is a shot. It's her just into her face as little baby Jodie Foster. Like, it's like, I gotta go get your medicine, and runs up the stairs, and it's following her. It's just her face in the frame. And then you realize all of this was a reflection in a mirror as she gets to the medicine cabinet and opens the medicine cabinet. So there's a seamless transition to this shot of following her up the stairs to her, you know, you can't actually shoot in a mirror because it's a stationary mirror. Mm-hmm. I don't know where the seam is. I don't know how they did it. The digital stuff. It is such a neat shot. And it's like, it's not really there for you to notice. It's just neat.
That's Bobby Z for you.
It's really
love it
good.
When he does that.
You know what? This movie has problems, but I mean, I've said it a million times. I like myself some hard sci-fi, and I think this is very thorough in dealing with some of the things. How would aliens contact us? What kind of stuff would they want to talk about? What would they send if they're not just beaming us messages of like people over?
The populace would react.
Or why would
how...
they need to contact us? I don't feel the need to have contact with bears because there's nothing I need from bears.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that the alien dad explains is like, we can't just show up. Everyone will freak out. So we do it this way. We've done it this way for a long time where it's like, we let one person come and we talk to them and say like, you're right, there's aliens, and they go back and no one fucking believes them.
Well, it's such
and
a great
then
it's
there's
such a great
going
trick.
To be more and then the movie ends.
It's such a great trick at the end of just like that she comes back and then he tells her like, no, nothing showed up, we didn't see all the stuff you saw, and we think you're just making it up or you got tricked by this person. And then it is revealed that James Woods knows that she did see them because they're like, yeah, we only got back static. 16 hours of static when she was gone for 5 minutes. So, yeah. And he's like, yes, that is interesting. And the world must never know. this came out the week after Men in Black.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
there are two films about aliens and keeping it a secret from the government in a week.
Mm. Both equally hilarious.
A secret revealed to me. I'm sure I'd seen Kiki's Delivery Service. I didn't know that was a signature studio putting out a film like that. But Princess Mononoke debuts in Japan.
Yeah, Mononoke Hime, as it was called there. It debuted in Japan. It would go on. Sadly, it would be the number one box office hit in Japanese film history until Titanic.
And then Spirited Away stole it again.
Yes, but it was a huge, huge deal. Studio Ghibli had been created like in the mid-80s to be the home of the top animators in Japan, led by Hayao Miyazaki and Isao Takahata. And this would be what Miyazaki wanted to be his final film. He's working on it.
Jesus, in 97?
Yes. He's like Hideo Kojima of just saying, like, no, I'm retired now. So he's working on this, and this takes so many of the themes he loves, which are like environmentalism,
folklore,
the dangers of capitalism, folklore, naturalistic beauty, also like steampunk. It has all this stuff in there, and it's an amazing film, and it got so huge in Japan that Disney finally decided nobody was getting to localize and bring over officially to America Miyazaki's films, because he steadfastly refused, because he let them bring over Nausicaa in the 80s and it was hacked to pieces in the localization. He's like, never again.
There was a version of Totoro.
Yes, to Fox, they got
it. There's a non-Disney version. It's like the only non-Disney localization. But I think they made a rule, like, you can't cut anything.
He made the rule of you can't cut anything, and that was so...
And you see,
this got so big.
Literal cultural differences of girls with their shirts off and...
Yeah.
Nudity.
Yeah, or smoking.
Smoking.
Or gun violence, all these things that just get lost in translation. But he had a very clear rule of, like, you can't change anything. And Mononoke is not even for kids at all. He didn't make it for kids. It is a bloody, violent movie. I mean, not R-rated, but it's almost...
Well,
but so,
dude, when that thing's head goes off...
Yeah, that's true. So it is R-rated. But anyway...
Disney had previously localized Kiki's Delivery Service, a much more family-friendly film, gave it straight to video release. But this, I remember, a big marketing blitz leading up to this.
So they put out Kiki first on VHS, but they made the deal for a theatrical release of Mononoke. And they wanted to make a huge deal about Mononoke that they even hired Neil Gaiman to write the script. So they're like... And they made it work. They got big name actors. It's honestly too literal of a translation.
It's the most bored I've seen Billy Bob Thornton in my entire life.
Well, and it was still... I remember being in a theater in 98, seeing this. Like, I was so hyped for it, and I loved it. And it was me and my mom and brother, a group of weeaboos, including a guy wearing literally a Dragon Ball Z t-shirt, and then a family, and they're like, after the first head is removed, they're like, well, we're out of here. Cartoons aren't for kids. This is how they found out. And so this was not a huge hit in America. His stuff would only really be embraced in more mainstream in America with Spirited Away, which is a more kid-friendly film.
But they're both
great films.
I mean, I think Spirited Away is his masterpiece, but... Can I say, there has been much discussion about my hatred / allergy to anime. I am, honestly, I used to think I just hate anime. Now I think I'm just allergic to anime. Mm. And many, many friends going back decades have tried, like, no, you'll like this one. Mm-hmm. And then they show me Akira, and I'm like 20 minutes in, and I'm like making fun of it. I can't. It's not clicking. It just won't work. And they've tried, how about this one? Like, I'm just yelling about the big eyes and the schoolgirl skirts. I can't. How about this one? And so I started dating Michael.
Ooh.
He likes anime.
Michael and Diana, year one.
Yeah, exactly. Michael and Diana, Origins.
Origins.
And he likes anime, and he starts talking about Miyazaki. And I'm like, I don't know what this. Oh, he's just, Japanese film. And then he's got like a picture of Totoro. And I'm like, that's cute, but no. Many have tried. Many have tried. They have all failed. You can't make me watch anime and enjoy myself. It's just not possible. And he finally, I don't know if there was a bet involved or something, but he finally sat me down, watched Princess Mononoke. Mm-hmm. And it's the first thing animated, I think in all of Asia possibly, that I sat through and enjoyed. Somehow Miyazaki is the one thing I'm not allergic to.
He kind of transcends.
Yes, it's not a mystery because he doesn't live in a land of... and it's, American television.
It's not the manga style. I understand.
But it's anime is very tropey.
Oh, and, God. And that's my problem with it.
And not to get into all that, but more than anything, Studio Ghibli in general is huge on craft.
Yes.
And prioritizes the artist in a way that most of the studios don't.
And you can tell.
Mm-hmm. Well, Miyazaki isn't into those tropes. Like, if you watch documentaries with him, he is a grumpy old man who hates anime tropes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that he was already a grumpy old man 20 years ago. But he's also the greatest animator of his generation, perhaps ever, just pure animator. And the last thing I'll say, we talked about Pixar earlier. I feel pretty certain in America, we wouldn't have these Miyazaki films officially if not for John Lasseter pushing for it. Yeah. In 97, he had enough sway within Disney to get that deal done. And John Lasseter, unlike a lot of Americans, is friends with Miyazaki. Miyazaki loves what he does. Yep. They talk all the time. Like, they are buddies. And so... that's why Lasseter introduces all the movies just on the VHS or in the original VHS.
And if you buy, if you buy the VHSs of the movies, John, if you guys don't know who Hayao Miyazaki is, I can't wait to tell you.
I'm telling you, please, trust me, the guy who gave you Toy Story, these are good.
One, you're assuming everybody knows who you are. But that's what's really great about it, and just being going to the museum over there and Studio Ghibli, probably the best animation house in Japan, but also very Japanese, by the rules. I can't believe they wouldn't localize their movies over here unless the biggest movie studio in the country could pay for it.
Nobody else could afford it.
Even then, they have all these rules, like you can't cut anything. If you've ever tried to buy one in a store, they're outrageously expensive. If you try to buy one in a store in Japan, they're even more outrageously expensive, from $40 to $70. And they also have a rule, try and rent them on Amazon or iTunes. It is not possible because Studio Ghibli says, no, you can never, ever make these available streaming. And they're still not. They're like some of the only movies that are like that. But so I'm asking you, go into a Best Buy.
Yes.
Maybe order, get something shipped from Amazon. Get some Ghibli in your life. It'll be good. Yeah. It'll be fun.
Yeah. Yep.
But moving into TV, God, what a boring transition. MLB All-Star Game.
I just want to mention that. It was the first time the All-Star Game had been on Fox, so it was the big All-Star Game.
Ruined Futurama for me.
Is like 96, 97 is when Fox really put their stamp on sports.
I'd never seen another network be like MLB on Fox. Just to let you know, we're a real network now.
I think 1997 is the first time Fox had the Super Bowl. I think 96 or 97 was the first time they had the World Series, and they started delaying
the treehouse. Really put yourself out there with the sports stats.
Because this is what... the reason I remember 96, 97 is because that's when they started delaying the Treehouse of Horror to after Halloween.
Boom.
Yes, and then...
hold on. I want to see if you get this theme song, because this made me fall in love with television. I think it was I pirated HBO into my parents' house and pirated cable into my room. And I was mostly into big budget movies, cartoons, comedy shows. And I don't know what it was, just watching HBO. This is the first hour long drama I ever saw. And it's Oz.
Oz is the true beginning of prestige HBO TV. It really was.
I mean, it looks so
and
cheap.
For adults, grown up adults.
We're like 2 years away from Sopranos starting, right?
I rewatched clips of it, and it looks like a BBC show now. Just like, you had $8 for this.
It looks real. The debut of Edie Falco, she did the show for as long as she could, in addition to The Sopranos.
Ada Turturro had been cast in it too, like a million. And also all your favorite people from The Wire were in this
too. I've seen a couple people from Lost.
For
Echo Michael.
I am pissed off that Adebisi is now known as the guy from Lost. Adebisi is one of the most timeless characters ever.
Sister Echo's pretty cool too.
So the secret of Oz is that it was a soap opera and pro wrestling on TV, but in a prison.
But with more rape.
And also like race riots. Like, it was as it is in
I'll say if you want to revisit Oz, the first season, 6 episodes, it is really good. And it is not solely a soap opera, because it's very, very political about race, the prison system, and justice. And then it gets a little cheaper, and it introduces more characters, and it gets a little more outlandish.
Well, on every season... they take over a year off between seasons, and so when they'd have but they were like 8 episode seasons, so you get 8 episodes, they take a year off, and then like 3 actors couldn't come back. So like, well, that guy escaped, and this guy got murdered off screen. That guy is in a new prison. So sorry, they're not back. And then they introduced new people, and it was also the show way before Game of Thrones of like For anybody sure. can die. You don't yep. know who's yeah. going to die. They killed fucking everybody on that show. Mm-hmm. It is a goofy-ass show to watch, too, though, of all, like, the Dutch angles mm-hmm. they had. And, like, Harold Perrineau giving, like, speeches, monologues yeah. all the fucking time about the plot of
what
that episode.
What is prison?
Mm-hmm. Who is reality?
Even after he dies. And yes. again, Adebisi has my favorite scene. The Italian mafia goes to kill him. Mm-hmm. He knocks both of them out and rapes them.
Doesn't yeah. kill them because he's like he wants them to live in the shame instead. He's a monster. Everybody's a monster on that show.
Oh, yeah.
It was a point on the show too that Tom Fontana didn't want anybody to be innocent. He's like, no. These are all have to be guilty guys, and you have to live with guilty characters who are criminals and get to know them.
But the introduction yeah. of actors like J.K. Simmons. And
Simmons is so terrifying.
Nazi.
Wow. Yes. So terrifying.
Yeah,
he is because he's so calculating.
Yeah, the I Love You
so
Man
good.
From Wayne's World, now in a major role, Tobias Beecher.
Yeah. Yes, Christopher Maloney as Keller. The a love for the ages between Beecher and Keller.
Got so Shakespearean towards the end.
And then when you see them, every now and then you see them together on SVU and think like, I've seen these two guys make out.
Yeah, these guys have like fought. Well, yeah, because Beecher will show up sometimes as like, this guy was some rapist or something.
No. I mean, Maloney was
Maloney and Simmons, yes. Yeah. J.K. Was also, Simmons yeah. was... He was just like the therapist on SVU,
yeah.
yes.
I think Beecher was also Chet on the TV version
yes,
of
yes,
Weird Science.
Oh, my God.
But the show, and Beecher is the new guy, the not-career criminal who's being destroyed by two. But it's also a show about Oz, the mm-hmm. special section of it that like
yeah,
is extra prison, where it's like there's more rules, but you also have some more freedom.
There's more rules, but there's no cages.
Yeah, you're in glass cells.
Yeah, and it's not the typical grid-like cell structure, and everybody wants to be in there because it's a little friendlier.
Better than Gen Pop.
Better than Gen Pop. Damn, I missed the show. Yeah, because
it
made me care about dramatic television. Mm-hmm. I really liked it. I have to imagine it was really important. Mm-hmm. The Saturday Night Live's 20th season debuted with Jerry Seinfeld.
Yes.
Saying that at the end of Seinfeld, he was sentenced to go to Oz Penitentiary and he meets all the cast members, and people are cheering, so I have to, assume everyone knew the show.
Stuck me with an AIDS-infected needle. Well, good luck with that.
Good luck with all that.
And also, Dean Winters is fucking, he fucking rules on it.
And his brother. How about them apples guy?
Oh, yep. Rita Moreno.
Rita Moreno. Ernie Hudson.
In a show that is technically should be all men, it has way better parts for women on it than most shows do.
Wong and very multicultural at that.
Yeah, and
Luke Perry.
I saw Luke Perry's dick on that show.
Yeah.
And oh my god, and Lance Reddick. Lance Reddick fucking rules it for the two seasons he's on there.
Yeah,
it's so many. And yeah, Edie Falco just gets like taken. It's funny on the commentaries on some of the seasons. Like Tom Fontana even just says like, Sopranos took another one from us. That like that oh that good small actor there. Yeah, they took him. Like,
I remember reading Edie Falco had to rigorously go take classes to get rid of her New Jersey, New York accent to be on Oz, then to be cast in The Sopranos. And like, could you relearn all that?
Yeah, talking that accent again. It's a great
Townie.
Show. It is very dated. It's kind of silly. I remember a storyline where they have to.
Silly.
Take old age pills. They're like, well, instead of staying here till you're 60, we'll just make you have pills till you're physically 60.
Then, oh man, there's in the later seasons they lose the ability to shoot outdoors.
Yes.
And you can tell that like you just got to use like a camcorder with no lights.
Yeah.
Like that's the only way you can shoot scenes outside the prison.
And also it gets to the point of like, well, this would famously be if this was an actual prison in real life would be the murder prison. I'm like, well, this was the place where the lieutenant governor was murdered, and this is also the prison where a reporter came in here to film a show and got murdered. It's just like, and this was after 3 years ago there was a full-blown riot here.
And that's the conclusion of the first season. I thoroughly recommend it. It might hold up. I don't know. I'm not going to state my reputation.
It's got great acting, and it is a soap opera of just like, man, it's the Italians versus the African group now. Who's going
to
do it?
I just have to say that because great actors on it, and most of them they killed in the first and second season.
Yes. Yep.
And one of the guys who stuck around, I didn't mention it on Laser Time's Best Of, but I meant to. I love Better Call Saul, and it's a prequel, so the bell-ringing Salamanca character. He might have seen him in Pi. He was one of the only actors in Pi, but he was... one of the main bad guys in Oz.
Yeah, hell, he's in Scarface. He goes way back.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, well, enough about Oz. I want to know about this. Apartment 2F debuts.
On MTV, there was a sitcom called Apartment 2F that was Sklar brothers, Randy and Jason Sklar. They
you might recognize them from annoying Burger King commercials.
So it was
or
only
just being on Better Call Saul.
They're the best. I love them.
And they were just in like 10 episodes of it, but they used it as a platform to get their other indie comedy buddies for it. And that's why the only result you will find for Apartment 2F on YouTube, as I would find out, is when Zach Galifianakis made a very early appearance on it. It is strange.
Oh, forget about the cloth. The stitching is a travesty.
Yeah! Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Together by children.
Right.
You know what else I don't like? The color?
We are all being duped.
All right, the way it's him reviewing jeans.
Then. He is super skinny.
No beard.
No beard, and those jeans are really high up.
Well, the plot is that they are focus testing jeans that nobody actually wants on them. But
his hair is also very high up.
You can see that it was MTV trying to transform him into an MTV actor, and he rejected it. And
VH1 talk show money.
In that scene, he pauses just a little bit. You're like, oh, that's a Zach Galifianakis charm there. He's not doing all the orders like every other actor.
Yeah, like Zero Tub.
Yes. So that was a completely forgettable MTV sitcom along with Austin Stories, which had premiered a little before that, which is even more.
Oh, hell yeah. Austin Stories.
Let's talk about me whooping ass and drinking beer.
When I fought Vince McMahon, that was awesome. Concludes Austin Stories.
We've got no notable video games this week.
Certainly not.
So let's just head on into 2007, and why don't we take ourselves out with, and because Diana demands it, Smash Mouse's Pedrino will be walking us down the aisle to 2007. Stay tuned, people. We'll be right back.
Mr. and Mrs. Internet and all the ships at sea, it's time for Diana's Classic Corner. We look even further back in time this week to see if there's anything worth a watching. And July 7th through the 13th, we got stuff we can talk about. 50 years ago this week, in 1967, Jerry Lewis's The Big Mouth came out. Jerry Lewis is The Big Mouth, and he directed The Big Mouth. I don't think one of his more beloved films, but yeah, whatever. And also 50 years ago this week, I was bummed to find out Vivian Leigh passed away when she was only 53. She had some emotional problems, I guess, but she was an amazing actress. I mean, Gone with the Wind, obviously, but Streetcar Named Desire, she's just so goddamn good. So I'd recommend that, but it's not my main recommendation because 75 years ago this week, July 10th, 1942, the not perfect, but still fucking great, Magnificent Ambersons came out. That's Orson Welles' follow-up to Citizen Kane, which, remember, only came out the year before. Unfortunately, there's footage missing. Like, something, I mean, it got taken away from producers, and there was some re-editing done, so it's not his perfect vision, but it's still a really, really good movie, and just some great performance in it. Joseph Cotten is great. Everybody's really good. It's about sort of this old-timey family and their travails over time and how they're sort of become society people and they're not, and they're come across hard times. And yeah, Agnes Moorehead is amazing in this movie. And it's just crazy that, like, when people think of her, they think of, you know, the grandma on Bewitched or something, but she's an incredible actress. So that's my recommendation. Magnificent Ambersons, you know, obviously it's not Citizen Kane, but it is still super worth a watch. And that's it for this week. Stay classic.
Ten is heading into 2007 with White People for Peace off of New Wave from Against Me. which has been called the best album of this year.
Yeah, Spin called Against Me's album back in 2007.
Well, Dave did
not
agree.
Back when there was a Spin, back when they were albums.
Dave does not agree with that and decided to leave the entire show because of the Against Me song.
Damn it.
Hopefully that doesn't turn off any more listeners, but stay tuned because we got a bunch of other fun stuff to talk about, including new albums. Super Taranta by Gogol Bordello.
Yeah,
sure. Our Love to Admire by Interpol. Zeitgeist, the first Reform Smashing Pumpkins album since since what? I thought I was going to be able to pull that out of my ass.
A couple
of
years.
St. Vincent's debut, Marry Me.
Oh, cool.
The Else by They Might Be Giants.
I'd stop listening by that point.
Yeah, me too. And guess what's at number one? It rhymes with Umbrella.
Yes, it's inescapable Rihanna, who's still a superstar.
Mm-hmm. Let's avoid the 2007 news. Let's say the iPhone is selling very well.
I would bet it is.
How about that? A bunch of weird movies this week. Rise Bloodhunter.
Oh, I looked into this.
What the hell is
this? Yeah, Lucy Liu and Michael Chiklis.
I hope there's a romance.
Well, post S.H.I.E.L.D., Michael Chiklis was like, I can be in movies now. And then after a few years of that, people were like, nah, you can't. Mm-hmm. We don't want you in movies. Like, and I love Michael Chiklis.
I love Chiklis.
Yeah, this is not going to be anyone's starring turn here. I mean, it's produced by Sam Raimi, but it's a cheapo kind of movie. It's Blade. Everyone just called it as a bad Blade. Mm. The girl gets Lucy Liu wakes up after being attacked, and she's a vampire now. And now she's gonna go kick the asses of the vampires that fucked with her. And Chiklis is like a detective or something. It looks bad.
You don't kill vampires in my town. That was too Steven Seagal. Let me take that back, Chiklis. You're much better than that.
He'd be a little quieter. You gonna kill vampires in my town?
This is ripped from my fantasies. Captivity, starring Alicia Cuthbert. I've never heard of this film either. No, I think I have. Because
I've seen the box to it on a shelf.
The next
that
film,
I stocked.
I was like, I've never heard of that. And then I looked at the poster and like, I totally saw that movie.
Yes,
This movie, Talk to Me, starring Don Cheadle, and I'm going to learn how to pronounce this, Chiwetel Elijah. How do you say it?
Ejiofor.
Chiwetel Ejiofor.
I call him the operative.
Chewy.
Serenity.
There you go.
But this film.
I'm a recovering alcoholic, been sober 5 hours.
Oh, no.
Some of my best friends is pimps, whores.
Open this door! You're both in trouble!
Two men will break all the rules.
I've been trying to call the police, but all our lines have been flooded.
Are these listener calls?
Electrify a city.
Good evening, Washington. My guest tonight is a pimp that I wouldn't trust to wash my car.
I want to watch this.
Tons of fun. Like,
fun role for Don Cheadle. I think it's at this stage of my life, I love researching people and things. And if I see a movie's coming out, I'm staying away from the information on Dunkirk. Diana slightly shames me with not knowing anything about that, but it's just like, I'd kind of like
to... Well, we're Americans. We don't learn stuff about World War
I.
Sorry.
Care about
it's
any
not
foreign
World
people.
War I, God damn
it's World War II.
It is World War II. Yeah.
It's World War II, for fuck's sakes, just before we showed up.
Well, then
get
it doesn't
there
matter.
In 10 years. Hold
God,
on.
World War II started when D-Day happened, right?
Just over 10 years. But I'd never heard of this guy. PD something or other. But Don Cheadle is playing an immensely popular Washington, D.C. DJ. Who is, I cannot emphasize look into him. I think he has the record in Washington, D.C. for the most people showing up to his funeral.
Whoa.
Because that's how popular he was in the D.C. area. But it's a lot like Private Parts, the Black Private Parts, let's call it that. an edgy DJ breaking a bunch of barriers in Washington, D.C. and became very famous.
Martin Sheen plays the angry white guy who's just like, he's the pig vomit.
You goddamn motherfuckers.
And that these were the kind of roles before he became an Oscar winner that Chiwetel would end up in. And just like, well, you're the straight man to the more fun guy in this. Mm-hmm. So he was always in supporting roles like that one. Now he gets to star and stuff.
Yeah. Now, looking into it, I see it's directed by Cassie Lemons, who's a filmmaker that I like. She made a film called Eve's Bayou. The 94 or so.
Eve's Bayou is great.
It's a great movie.
Women were allowed to direct movies.
I know, women of color even.
Ralph Peavy Green, an ex-con, who becomes a popular talk show host and community activist during the 1960s. But if I recall, the movie is... it's exactly what you think it is. It's a biopic, but it's just about an important figure I never would have heard of otherwise if I hadn't gotten this movie in a lot of high-definition DVDs in the year 2007.
Dan Cheadle is a very charismatic man.
I love Don Cheadle. So,
but it got overshadowed, though.
Yes.
Yikes.
Probably pretty significant counter-programming to the number one movie at the box office this week, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix.
The fifth movie slash book in the series that I had, this was the first one I saw that I had read the book before the movie. And so it was the one where it mattered. The movie meant less to me because I was like, oh, but I imagine this perfectly in my brain. Mm-hmm. So seeing it in the film, it's so Voldemort came back at the end of four, at the end of Goblet of Fire.
And he killed the pretty vampire kid.
Yeah, and so now he's
Cedric Diggory. I just don't remember Robert Pattinson's name.
But so now he's operating in the shadows, collecting back all his Death Eaters to kill all the non-pure-blooded magic users, and he is able. They are able to also take over, in a way, the Hogwarts, and Dumbledore is replaced, and there's a new evil force there. It's also. They start forming Dumbledore's army because of a very horrible, awful woman who takes over. Like Dolores Umbridge, I think, is one of the greatest characters that J.K. ever created.
Thatcher.
Yes, she is. She is such an old Tory who is just like that. She isn't actually a Death Eater. Like she isn't a Nazi, but she's just their best friend who's just like, no, I'm not a Nazi, but. There are rules, and
she's a fascist.
She is totally a fascist.
There's a difference between everybody. A fascist and a Nazi. That's fair. Okay.
And that she took over once the Nazis do take over in the seventh book, she is more than happy to be part of their government. And that the way she is racist, that she's against, like, you're a half-blooded giant. Get out of here, you giant. Or you're a centaur. Ugh, what? Get away from me. And so she also hates half-bloods and mug-bloods. I shouldn't even say that.
Don't say it, Hank. Your word.
And so, of course, she hates Harry Potter and thinks that Harry Potter is some fancy boy who thinks he's better than everybody else. Mm-hmm. And so then she punishes him in one of, like, the most painful scenes in the entire series by making him... she thinks, he's just going to be asked to write sentences that say, I must not tell lies. But he finds out that it's a bit worse than that.
Nothing. That's right. Because you know, deep down, you deserve to be punished. Don't you, Mr. Potter?
That she has all these like cute things around her, and that she's wearing like pink chiffon outfit. Like,
what's the actress's name?
Imelda Staunton.
I had just seen her in Vera Drake.
Oh my god!
So I thought this was I'd never seen her
Vera
before.
Vera Drake is why she got cast as Umbridge. I'd say
she is amazing. She's one of those like just sort of lifer British quality folks. She was just in. I want to see it because I think they're showing it in movie theaters around in the U.S. But she just did a version of Virginia. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? That's her and the guy that plays the spider on Game of Thrones. And I'm like, I am down. Varys, that guy.
And she is amazing.
I can imagine her doing Virginia Woolf and killing it.
So. One of my other favorite scenes in it too is when she's trying to get a secret out of Harry. And she's trying to get like the truth serum from Snape, and Snape pretends that he's out of truth serum, and then he's doing his best to save Harry, but he can't give up his cover, as we would know later. And then she is actually ready to torture him, and like this is J.K. Rowling's like commentary on things. It's just like, yeah, they'll just torture people. They'll say they don't, but they will.
I don't know if we talked about it here, but the movies, rightfully so, left out a lot of the time Iraq War. With us or against us mentality, the nature of the rise of Fox News. A lot of that shit is in the first Harry Potter books. A lot of condemnation of the press and a complicit government. It's very maybe I'm reading too much into it.
No, J.K. Rowling was putting all that in.
But knowing what I know about her now, it seems pretty on the nose. I read all the books at this point, and I had a little different experience because I was so bummed out. I have an odd relationship with the Harry Potter movies. The first two, I think, are fucking terrible.
Yeah.
Oh, they're awful. And, they are terrible.
The third one is amazing.
Yes.
And I don't care that much about the fourth one, but I really like the fifth one because it's basically like Magician's Resistance.
Yeah.
Underground Resistance, really neat. Probably more important now than ever. But but I read the book, and spoiler alert, Gary Oldman, Sirius Black, is killed at the end of the book. And I'm like, I remember poring over the pages like, there's got to be some ambiguity here. It's magic. Sirius Black isn't gone, who is now my new favorite character. And being in the movie theater, it's just like, I know what's going to happen, but the movie's not going to be able to be ambiguous.
Right.
It's he's dead or he's not. And
this was before... deaths on screen or on page in Harry Potter books of real characters that people were invested in, she crept up into them like, oh, this character disappears, or it's implied they're dead, and this was another of her slow walking up to killing people, just like, he is put behind a veil that then consumes his body and he can never return, so he is dead.
The movie made it unequivocally clear that Gary Oldman would not be back.
But it was different than being zapped and being a corpse, which is what would happen to Dumbledore and many more. Like,
I couldn't believe I just remember writing, and then Tonks was dead. And then Lupin was dead. And like, oh man.
Oh, I mean, Seven is it is a murder spree, and we're not too far away from the seventh book in our timeline too. No,
I remember I skipped work working with you guys to finish the book in like two sittings.
Oh my gosh!
I read it voraciously.
See, I've never read any of the books, so I'll say, I hate 1 and 2. I love 3, 4, 5, and 6. Do kind of run together.
Oh, yes.
That's why I was like, oh, and it's the one with Dolores Umbridge. It's the one with Imelda Staunton. I'll go, oh. it's with evil Margaret Thatcher.
But that's how the books are. Like, 3 kickstarts this, like, there's a giant problem in the magic universe, and it starts in 3, year 3. The first two are just like, it's an adventure every single year.
Well, so 1 introduces the whole Voldemort thing, and then 2, that you think it could be like, that's another Voldemort adventure again with Harry, and they're like, no, it's Voldemort. And so in 3, that's when you could tell she clearly knew, this is how all the rest of the books are going to go, and I'm starting here.
Man, I bought the book version of the play. I forgot I was into Harry Potter. I was.
Yeah, and in between, in the time it took her to write like 4 of those books, George R. R. Martin hasn't finished 1. Like, it's, you know.
But you don't understand, George R. R. Martin doesn't have any kids. What the fuck, George?
No, he is enjoying being famous. I get that. It's nice.
But I thought this was one of the better movies.
I think
I would rate this 3, 5, and 7.2 for my top 3.
Yeah, me too.
But that concludes the movie discussion of the 2007 segment. Stay with us, if you will, for the July 7th through the 13th. Live Earth on TV, the Live Earth concert brought together by Al Gore.
Yes, they wanted to do Live Aid, but for climate change. It was about climate change awareness, which many people,
whenever something is to raise awareness, you should probably hear pat myself on the back.
Aww. Yeah, and that's really what it was. But it wanted to be like Live Aid, which was multiple concerts across the world going on, and so they set it up as well. Al Gore was a figurehead of it, and he was getting mocked on both sides. He was getting mocked by Republicans who said, this is you trying to advertise your presidential run in 2008, which he's like, I am not planning that. Quit saying that. And he wasn't. And then on the left side.
Never seen that interested.
And then on the left side, they're like, you're creating a massive carbon footprint to raise awareness on climate change, which most people already know about.
All these private jets, all the plastic cups that people are going to leave behind.
It's
fucking stupid.
I was hoping there was going to be there were bigger reunions at it, but the biggest reunion is Spinal Tap.
Wow.
Yeah.
They get together and perform live.
It is the best part because they play Big Bottom.
At Wembley Stadium.
At Wembley Stadium, massive stadium. And they basically have the bassist of every other band come on to play with. Plus they got James Hetfield, Kirk Hammett, Adam Yash, RIP. So like everyone that can hold a bass guitar, all coming. So I counted. There's like 15 basses.
Wow.
So I grabbed a little clip of it just so you can hear what 15 basses playing sounds like.
Take it, boys.
The stage is just covered in bassists.
Wow.
Yeah, that is quite a visual. What is funny to see, like, these older guys in their wigs still, too.
And they're still... Yeah. Bass solos. You can't hear anything. It doesn't matter, man.
That is so great.
It's
really
so much fun.
Clip.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see him.
That's probably the last time they'll ever be reunited. What with Shearer hating Michael McKean and also suing Canal Films.
They all joined on board with him. Harry Shearer just was willing to put up the money to do it. Michael McKean, Better Call Saul. Just want to call it out again.
Oh my God, fantastic, he's so good. There.
Of the best.
It's one of his best acting performances ever, and I think of him largely as a funny dude. And that is one of the most painful characterizations of anybody I've seen in a while. But yeah, Live Aid. What else we got? July 8th, reality show parody Total Drama Island premieres in Canada.
This is meaningless to us, but for the people 10 years younger than us, they probably watch this all the time on Cartoon Network. It was Total Drama Island. It was just a parody of... It was a parody of a Survivor style reality show, except it was made by Canadian production too, so it was extra weird, and it aired on the Teletoon Network in Canada a year earlier. But so this is when Total Drama Island came out.
And also on July 10th, we got another MLB All-Star game. There was a winner.
American League won it again.
I would never even go down that limb. Greek debuts on ABC Family, a very non-family show about fraternity life on ABC.
Like it was ABC them trying family. To shake their style. They're like, we're not the Christian Broadcasting Network anymore. We're going to be about a fraternity.
That would explain the Freeform change, because you could tell they wanted to like get those shackles off. We do not play the 700 Club every morning anymore.
Fuck no. And so, apparently Clark Duke and Schmitty from New Girl were on it.
Someone cheats on you and you dump them.
You'll learn you left black and white back in high school.
Oh, sex.
They're having illicit sex and drinking. Oh.
Where are we? What's your favorite ABC Family show?
I think the original, they had a Zorro show in like 93. I watched it quite a lot.
You could just say Harry Potter, because that's practically what defines the network.
Yes.
And I remember as a Disney nerd, I'm like, you know, you own movies too. It doesn't have to be all Harry Potter and the Minions on the Disney Channel.
Well, they're called by the Disney Channel, you know?
Yeah, but that is it for television that week. In 2007, Games Project Silphied hits the 360.
A hyper Japanesey game, not very good.
And Sonic the Hedgehog re-releases on Xbox Live Arcade, which is a semi-big deal.
It is a big deal now that Sonic the Hedgehog has been re-released on everything ever 8 times.
Yes, but a port-perfect downloadable version on the Xbox Live Marketplace, which wasn't oversaturated with things just yet. I guess we knew you could put a game that old and recreate it fully with 100% authenticity, but it hadn't really happened at that moment. And Sonic is a good character and game to show people what's possible. I think Street Fighter 2 had already entered on the Xbox Live Marketplace.
And it would take 5 or 6 years before Sonic CD would finally come to it, because they actually did have to just make it again from scratch or close to it.
And that concludes most of the media that week. We are supported by Patreon. We have a Patreon, patreon.com/lasertime. I think I said Patreon 4 times.
Patreon.
Every 2 weeks now, we're going to do a comment or readdress some of these topics with a lot of your feedback. It has been really, really fun. I cannot believe Diana has missed 2 episodes because I'm bad at scheduling things.
Yeah.
But it is a lot of work. But it's an extra thing we want to do for our patrons who keep us going, help putting food in our mouths, keeping the lights on, and keeping the equipment up to date. Seriously, thank you about that. We do not make a lot of money on these shows. This show in particular, no money. But
public service. This is all tax deductible.
Yes. Oh, why? We got to get that status. If it worked for Scientology, it can work for us. Here's an example of some of the comments we got from our episode 2 weeks ago covering Face Off. And Michael Moore Sicko, Watership Down Syndrome, said that Face Off blew me away when I first saw it. For a brief time, it was actually my all-time favorite movie. It's still an amazing action movie, no doubt. The boat chase is especially spectacular, and there's probably no greater moment of movie symbolism than the mirror shootout. Where they look in the mirror, but they do not see themselves, but who are they trying to kill? But boy howdy, has my overall opinion of the movie cooled over the years. It's still fun, but it's fallen way out of my top 10. I could never call it a sincere top 10, but it's really fun.
But it's fun.
It is fun. And he also says of Sicko, wow, what a week to mark the movie's anniversary.
Yeah.
I still say that this is Moore's best work. Definitely his angriest, most brutal takedown of any of his subjects. And it is well earned. For profit health insurance is a goddamn tragedy. And there is some of the leftist politics that define our programs.
Yep.
Thank you. But we encourage everybody to listen. We're trying to just show everybody a good time. Those are his thoughts, not mine. I am all for not paying for your health insurance. I'm just kidding.
Let him die in a ditch. Who
I'm
cares?
On Obamacare. I'm going to lose my Obamacare. It's going to be wonderful. Patreon.com/lasertime for paying those higher premiums.
Is this plug time?
It is plug time. If Dave were here, he'd probably say, listen to Bonus Time. It's another. Yeah. It's a weekly exclusive show on the Lasertime Network where we talk about more current things that we're seeing and watching. We do love to watch movies and read books and play the goddamn video games. It's a good way to keep up with us and what we're doing. We try and make it the best show we can. Laser Time, if you like this show and the work we put into it, the sound, the infusement of all the sounds, Laser Time is like that, but with topics. We've done female superheroes lately, farts, and a best of the year so far. where I forgot to mention Better Call Saul, and this whole episode has been my apologies. Because I just watched the finale, and it's really... Wow. It's unnecessarily fucking good. Because there's no prequel should be good. This is mostly a legal drama. Mm-hmm. And from a thing about meth crime. Like, it shouldn't be as fun to watch as it is, and I love it. But yeah, check that out. All that stuff is on LaserTimePodcast.com. We have a YouTube channel there. You can see all the videos we've made. Look at Marvel cards. Fantasy fights where we steal IP and put them in a wrestling match. And of course, I just recently made a giant sizzle reel of ass farts and butt shit called Gaming's Greatest Farty Butts, which I only called for better SEO. I wanted to maintain gaming's most important farty butts and steal that back from GR. But so it goes. Any other plugs, Hank?
Well, I'm HENERYG on Twitter, and if you love all this nostalgia, you should listen to Talking Simpsons, where we go through every episode of the show from the beginning. We are at about the end of season 5 now. Pretty exciting, and woo-hoo. It's gone so well for us that me and the co-host, Bob Mackey, we have moved it over to its own Patreon for us to do more exclusive stuff so we can do it full-time after quitting our job. So you should check out all the extras we have over there for just as low as $5 a month. Patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons.
Yeah, and if you like video games, there's also Video Game Apocalypse, which is a weekly show just about video games. And you want to talk classic movies or whatever, I'm on Twitter now at LeCineNerd.
We on that show, we should have been talking about our favorite games of the year so far.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Very, very fun.
About
check it all out.
Time.
LaserTimePodcast.com. Diana, I got to know who's dead.
I'm afraid 2007, 10 years ago, Lady Bird Johnson passed away.
Lady Bird!
She was 94.
Wow.
I did not realize that, yes, former First Lady, Lady Bird Johnson.
Is her real name Lady Bird?
No, it is not.
Okay, couldn't be.
But that's just what people call
Lady
her.
Lady Bird.
She lived that long.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
I know. She just sort of retired, too. It's like whenever there was, you know, some sort of big public event, like, oh, and all the former presidents would be there, and the First Ladies, yeah, she wouldn't. Just whatever. Apparently,
I saw
she's
her,
just fine.
I saw her dress at the Smithsonian recently.
Yep.
Diana, you know what it's time for, right?
Is it?
Oh, birthday is a doodly.
The birthday quiz, people.
Birthday quiz time. All right, one man and one woman born this week.
I'm ready.
Gents up first. Born July 13th, 1940. He grew up in Yorkshire in an abusive household, probably because his dad had PTSD from...
Patrick Stewart.
Dunkirk. Patrick Stewart.
Boom! Well, damn it!
Wow.
I didn't have any fucking
that
chance
was
there.
Fast.
Jesus.
Yeah, he's Patrick Stewart's real big on domestic violence causes.
Yes,
he is.
I did know that. But damn.
Yeah.
Wonderful
I
man.
Should have mentioned, yeah, he joined the Royal Shakespeare Company in 1966, more than 50 years ago.
God, I'm good at this!
He
Somebody pay me!
Knighted in 2010, and it is reflected in his Twitter handle.
live forever.
Yes, I love him so much.
Yes,
I just love him so much. He's just a cool guy. Anyway, lady time. Born July 10th, 1972.
Okay.
She studied dentistry before dropping out for showbiz, first as a model, then in films such as Chasing Poppy and Madea Goes to Jail. And if you count endorsements, she is the highest paid woman on television 5 years in a row.
Oh, fuck. What's her name? I have to look up her goddamn name, because I couldn't pronounce it.
Kerry Washington?
No.
No.
Oh, the cookie. It's a... no? Damn it.
Oh, you would have had it perfectly with a song.
Would it
yeah.
help that she was born in Colombia?
Boo.
Damn it.
I guess not, actually.
No? Nobody? Nobody?
What is her name? Colombia something?
No, her name's not Colombia. Jesus Christ.
We're all named after the country we're born in.
No, no. I give up.
Latina woman who's on television...
Rosario Dawson?
No. Oh my God. It's Sofia Vergara. What's wrong
with
you?
Oh,
fuck.
Wow.
Oh, I didn't know.
Oh
that.
My God. I'm very sorry. Sofia Vergara, yes.
You guys are terrible.
She is a huge, she is a super duper huge star. She is.
And a just ridiculously beautiful lady.
Yes.
And just,
yep.
She's beautiful compared to my age. I feel too old to jerk off to her. That's where we both are.
She's a grandparent now, I think.
Is she?
Like she
wow.
Is.
Wow.
Jeez.
Sofia Vergara.
She's cool. We like her.
Stay tuned. Another 6 years, we'll talk about Modern Family in 302010.
Hey.
Until then, we have to close us out. And since I sincerely doubt anybody wants me to close out with Buster Poindexter's Hot, Hot, Hot.
Please don't.
The only other music I think we all have a great connection with is the theme from Princess Mononoke. Beautiful music from one of the most beautiful movies ever. Go see it. Thank you, and join us next Thursday, 302010.net, lasertimepodcast.com. Bye!